91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Some listeners remember when the NFL had no stranglehold on city governments or television networks. Just Google the Heidi game, 1968. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Last year, the silly Deflate Affair led the news. It's clear that unless subsidies and perks are plenty, teams jump cities. Ridiculously, the NFL has nonprofit tax status. Its players are often cited for domestic violence and drug violations, and the league has danced around the science of long-term brain trauma. With NFL blessing, fantasy football brings illegal gambling info onto TV commercials. So what's good about pro or even college football? We'll discuss it with author and editor George Easterbrook next.
Julia.
Topical Currents.
Hello, this is Superintendent Alberto Carvalho. Join AgCount Miami to count the population of Miami-Dade youth 13 through 24 who do not have a permanent residence. Ask young people in distress to take a confidential survey beginning January 21st. Visit iCountMiami.com.
And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman.
And we had a lovely lunch.
Nice afternoon.
With friends and members. We want to thank all of them. And they are Robert and Valerie and Bill and Carl and Hamish and Wayne and Luis and Gloria for joining us.
One of the benefits of membership in WLRN, the next pledge drive, you can have lunch with Joe and Bonnie and do what these nice folks did. Some really interesting people we met today over lunch.
It's lovely.
It was provided by John Martin's in Coral Gables, the great Irish restaurant.
The Irish pub, been there for a long time. And very enjoyable.
Well, this hour we make a venture into the sports arena with writer and editor Greg Easterbrook. Sunday's Super Bowl will have one-third of the entire nation watching. But many folks have issues with pro football.
Although well-paid, some players will experience brain trauma issues after football. Each play has a chance of serious injury and paralysis. The NFL greedily takes advantage of local taxpayers while game tickets are incredibly high-priced. Yet, until last year, the league had nonprofit status.
Some players have issues of substance abuse and domestic violence, and the NFL paints itself as an essential facet of American life. Greg Easterbrook has written the book, The Game's Not Over, in defense of football, and he joins us from Bethesda, Maryland. Welcome to you, Greg.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, welcome. So why do you think it is at a time when the NFL is garnering more and more negative news coverage, the things that Joe just mentioned, the bullying, the chronic traumatic encephalopathy, suicides, murders, why is its popularity at an all-time high?
Well, I think you have to view, there's two separate things to look at. One's the NFL as a institution, and it's incorrigible. There are so many things wrong with it, we don't have time to list them all. The other is the sport of football. The sport of football is not only an athletic interpretation of what America is, but the way it's being played has never been better. The quality of the games themselves is the best that it's ever been. And I'll be on my way to California in a couple of days to attend the Super Bowl. I'm expecting a really good game. And I think the popularity is mainly that people are responding to the fact that the quality of the games is really high.
Why is this Super Bowl necessarily in the quality of the game? I know the athletes are bigger and stronger and faster, but better say than Johnny Unitas in the championship game in sudden death.
Well, I think in general, let's suppose I said you can get into a time machine and materialize at any NFL game chosen at random in any year, I sure would have picked 2015. I think the style of play is fabulous. The grace of the athletes, even some of the really big hulking guys have almost gotten to the point of graceful, is a lot of fun. The emphasis on passing and scoring, which is, as I lay out in The Game's Not Over, has been done largely by manipulation of the rules. The rules have been changed in the last decade, both to encourage passing, protect the quarterback, and the rules banning the deliberate helmet-to-helmet hit, which was a very necessary reform for safety reasons, in theory apply to everybody, but in fact they favor the offense. So if
don't,
you like
don't
scoring...
You, don't you find it strange, though, to have to watch it with every single pass play? They're crying for a pass interference call, and they get them a lot?
Have you watched an NBA game lately? Athletes claiming that they were fouled or sinned against is a kind of a runaway trend.
That's pretty standard.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I just want to get to, you have a metaphor you use throughout the book. You mentioned just now that football is the athletic expression of America. You use this metaphor to say that football, the NFL, is a mirror of American society. And I'm just wondering, is that a good thing or not such a good thing?
Well, in the book, I point out that two important things have happened at the same time in the last generation. And of course, the two things happening at the same time does not prove that one causes the other, but they may be related. The big increase in football popularity has happened in the last 25 years, whether it's attendance, ratings, which are skyrocketing, the incredible increase in the amount of money flowing into football, almost all from television. That's all a phenomenon in the last 25 years. Well, what happened 25 years ago? The Cold War ended. That was the biggest event for America since World War II ended, or biggest event for us as a nation. So what have we faced as a nation since then? Our status as the strongest, most muscle-bound, most powerful country in the world, and our own internal doubts about what's the proper way to use our incredible power. So what's become the sport that we're fascinated with? The strongest, most muscle-bound, and most powerful of all games, where we watch really gifted athletic men play out this drama of what's the proper way to use force. I think that the end of the Cold War and the escalation of popularity of football are really closely linked.
But I don't understand how football questions the use of its power. I mean, as Joe just mentioned, they've never been bigger, the players. The game is pretty violent in spite of, you know, the rules like you can't do helmet-to-helmet contact. So where is football questioning the use of its power?
Well, internally, the NFL does not do enough. As I detail in great detail, and the game's not over, there's all kinds of sleazy public subsidies to the NFL, all of which should end, but for stadium operations, tax exemptions, etc. I have one chapter where I compare what happened when the NFL held its draft in the city of Chicago's wonderful Grant Park last spring to what happened when Barack Obama accepted the presidency there. The Obama campaign paid the entire cost of the event, even though the election of the first African-American president and the third son of Illinois to go to the White House clearly was a public policy event that you could have argued that the taxpayer should pay for. Obama campaign paid for everything. When the National Football League went to Chicago, everything was free. Taxpayers paid for everything. They got this crazy special treatment with police escorts and so on, as if they were arriving heads of state. So there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes in the NFL that there should be populist outrage about, and I don't understand why there isn't. But in terms of the game, making the difference, drawing the distinction between the league and the game, in terms of the game has reformed a lot in the last 10 years. Now, maybe it was drag kicking and screaming into it,
right. But
there's a lot of change in health and safety regulations, especially involving neurology. We haven't gone far enough yet. There are more reforms needed, and I laid them out in the book. But remember, as recently as 10 years ago, special teams members were called the suicide squad because they were supposed to throw themselves in other people's bodies. Coaches said that they wanted to have headhunters, and a headhunter was somebody who leads with his helmet and tries to slam his helmet against another guy's helmet. That stuff is now viewed as barbaric by practically everybody, and it's now penalized by officials. As recently as 5 years ago, the NFL not only didn't do anything from a health standpoint about second impact syndrome, which increasingly looks like it's a lot more dangerous than concussions, and that means if you get a concussion and your brain swells, the second time your brain gets hurt is when the injury occurs. Well, there was not only no protocols to address this 5 years ago, but the league denied that it was a medical factor. Now everybody's really conscious of it. So I think a lot of positive changes have been made in the game, not enough. more are needed. But the game itself is both evolving somewhat in the direction of safety. It'll never be risk-free. And the sport is really good. So those two things balance off the nefarious, sinister nature of the NFL's owners.
Greg Easterbrook, you talked about in the book, tell us about your view of the three-point stance for down linemen and how that could be put in the rules that would be eliminated.
Well, that's one of the big reforms I advocate. I think the 3- and 4-point stance, the lineman or any player having his hand on the ground before the ball is snapped, that has to be eliminated. And I actually think that's going to happen fairly soon, like within the next few years. I think future football all players will start standing upright or with their hands on their thighs. If you look at any picture of a football game where the offense and defensive lines are facing each other before the snap, the linemen are all in a crouch position and where are their heads? Pointed right at each other's heads. And when the ball is snapped, their heads collide. If you banned the 3- and 4-point stance and made the players start in an upright position, it wouldn't eliminate helmet-to-helmet hits, but it would drastically reduce head impact. And I think it's something you could do that could make the game a lot safer. And if maybe you can say, and some people have made this argument, that, well, why should these NFL players, they're all multimillionaires, they're adults who are assuming a risk, why should I care if they injure their heads? Okay, why should you care? But I do care if youth and high school players injure their heads. And there are 2,000 NFL players. There are 3 million youth and high school players. So we really want to see them see the example of eliminating the three-point stance so that they're a lot less likely to hit each other in the head.
Well, I was going to get to this later, but we're talking about the reforms you suggest. The other one is getting rid of the kickoff. What would you explain that, and what would you substitute it for with?
There's actually not, now that we're really only in the first decade of careful study of neurology in not just football but in all contact sports. So a lot has been learned fast. And one of the things that's been learned through medical studies is that you're much more likely to sustain a head injury on the kickoff than on any other play in football. And the reason is just physics. If you think about what happens at a kickoff, two groups of 11 men, or boys if it's high school, run directly toward each other at maximum speed and collide. So it's a dangerous situation. Concussion rates and other kinds of brain trauma rates are much lower, are still a problem, but they're much lower on other kinds of play. So I just simply say just eliminate the kickoff. If you're a basketball fan, you remember there used to be a center court jump ball after every basket, and then people thought, well, that's the way the game, you can't touch that. Oh, we're purists. We don't want to change the game. The center court jump ball was eliminated. Most fans don't even remember that it existed anymore, but it certainly hasn't hurt the quality of the game. The quality of the game is great. So I think eliminate the kickoff. It's not going to hurt the quality of the game. In 5 years, people won't even remember there were kickoffs. And you can make an exhibit to the kickoff in the sport museum and put it next to the jump ball exhibit and forget that both those things ever existed.
What about punting?
Well, punting is a little different from a health and safety standpoint, because think about what happens on a punting play. Most players are not running directly toward each other. The players are colliding, but they're running in the same direction. And punting plays, by and large, have about the same concussion risk as other kinds of offensive plays.
We're going to continue our conversation with Greg Easterbrook, author, contributing editor to The Atlantic and Washington Monthly. And he's written...
The Game's Not Over.
The Game's Not Over.
In defense of football.
We'll be right back.
John Fashenda. The frozen tundra of Green Bay.
And we're back. It's today's topical currents.
Today's football.
NFL style. If you'd like to join in the conversation with Greg Easterbrook, he's the author of The Game's Not Over, In Defense of Football. You're certainly welcome. The number 1-800-743-9576. also email, that's radio at WLRN.org. Where do you stand on the NFL? Give us a call. Do you watch with some misgivings? Is it a guilty pleasure that you can't stop watching? And if the Dolphins or a team you root for was in the Super Bowl, would you feel emotionally tied to them, even if you
have
misgivings?
About emotion?
So, of course, that's a long shot right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, right. Greg, you brought up a really interesting point in the book, which you say that football is one of the last bastions where maleness is celebrated and hasn't been and won't be penetrated by women. Expand on that for us and why, what that is.
I wish that point was original to me, but I think it's an important one. I proposed a moment ago that the great jump in popularity of football coincided with the Cold War. What's another thing that it coincided with? Rising freedom, economic and political power for women. We're living in the last decade where we've not only had Speaker of the House and three female secretaries of state, but it's now increasingly common for CEOs of major corporations to be female, and not just consumer products corporations, but the CEO of Lockheed, the world's largest military contractor, today is a woman. So we're living in an era where women are attaining the freedom and economic power that they've always deserved, and that's fine in and of itself, but a lot of men feel under siege. They don't know where to retreat to, that women won't take over, and the only place you can be absolutely positive that women will never take over is the football field. So the football field gets more and more popular. Now, football popularity is also rising among girls and women, just as spectators who enjoy the game. So this is not the only thing that's going on, but it's certainly one of those things.
How do you feel about the fantasy football ads that are run during NFL games? I'm not sure what the status of that is right now, but they were claiming that it's not gambling fantasy football, that it's a game of skill, but still you actually are gambling on how your player does.
Well, if you notice that early in the season, ads for FanDuel and DraftKings, there were so many of them you wondered when the game was going to be shown. They've completely vanished from the airwaves in the last couple of months. My understanding of it, it's clear that both those companies and their imitators have pretty serious legal troubles, but I think they also have troubles with their consumers, too. I think people have begun to doubt whether the product is legitimate, which was always my concern. So as I was raised as a Baptist, I'm anti-gambling by nature. But in the specific case of that type of gambling, I was never really sure that it was on the level in the first place.
Well, do you think Sunday Super Bowl will be an over or under at 45?
I don't know. I haven't thought about that. I write a weekly column on football for the New York Times now, and every year I point out that if you want to predict the outcome of any game, the best thing to do is certainly not think about it. You don't even know who's playing. You need to know who's playing. The best formula for predicting the outcome of an NFL game is simply to predict that the team with the best record will win, and if the teams have the same record, you predict that the home team wins. I've been tracking that metric now for a decade, and in all but one year of the last decade, that metric has done better than any professional forecaster. I'd compare it against the 20 forecasts that are published weekly on ESPN.com.
But are you talking about against the spread, though?
No, not against the spread, just who wins the game.
Wow.
I told you I'm a Baptist. I don't care about the spread. If you just want to predict who wins the game, all you got to do is look at the team's record. And over the long term, that will be more effective than all other techniques.
All right.
Again, our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Email, if you prefer. That's radio at WLRN.org. Let's take a first caller. We've got George. He's in Hollywood. Hi, George.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Hi.
Interested in the topic, and I had a comment and then a question. I quit watching. I've been a casual NFL fan my life. I attended one game last year, so I'm not an avid fan. I quit watching earlier this year, early in the season, when Greg Hardy came back to the Cowboys. And with his domestic abuse record and with the praise of his owner, Jerry Jones, and that just kind of sickened me. And I calculated approximately there's 200 million football fans. I don't know. He was making $10 million we were each responsible somehow for about a nickel of his salary, and that did it for me. I didn't want to pay a nickel of his salary, so I quit watching. And my question is, something I've thought about since is, do you think that the behavior of football players, particularly with regards to domestic abuse, is commensurate with what's in the society, or are they much worse, as it seems from reading the news?
Greg?
Well, here's how I'd answer that question. I have several pages in the Game's Not Over where I look at criminality statistics for NFL players versus males of the same age in society at large. And the bottom line is that NFL players are roughly one-third less as likely, put it the other way around, a male of the same age is roughly three times more likely to have been arrested for or convicted of criminal behavior as an NFL player. Now maybe you assume, well, that's because the police cut NFL players special deals and they never end up on the police blotter like they should. And I think probably that does happen sometimes. But even if you assume that some NFL players are escaping from charges that they ought to face, it's still the case that NFL players commit fewer crimes than men of the same age. So what we're really seeing, not just because of the very high profile, outsized nature of the NFL, when an NFL player does something horrible, and they have done some horrible things, everybody finds out about it. Of course, everybody's seen the Ray Rice video. But the metaphor I use in the book is that the NFL has become the mirror that is held up to American society. When there's an issue like domestic violence, and the big debate on this started 2 years ago with Ray Rice punching his then fiance, it forced us to face the fact that there's too much domestic abuse all throughout society, and that nobody wanted to talk about it. And if you realize that it happens even to wealthy celebrity families of famous athletes, it's got to be that it's happening to a lot of people and we don't know about it. And I thought that was the same with Michael Sam, the first openly gay NFL player 3 years ago. When he came out, it sort of really changed the national conversation. It was only a fairly short time from Michael Sam coming out to national legalization of gay marriage. And I'm not saying that Michael Sam caused that to happen, but I am saying that the mirror that the NFL holds up to society, what do we see in that mirror? We see ourselves. It forces us to look at the good and the bad of ourselves, and domestic abuse certainly is one of the bad things.
Well, Greg, I just want to say something about that, because, yes, it's true, it brought a lot of attention to domestic abuse. But when you say, I guess what George was asking, if there's a correlation between violence on the field and violence off the field, when you say that there's only a 2% arrest or conviction of domestic abuse in the NFL, which is three times less than in the general public of men the same age, you do know that a huge percentage of domestic violence cases go unreported. And it's very difficult to get an arrest or a conviction, no less. And the other thing is that if that camera hadn't photographed or videotaped Ray Rice in the elevator with his fiancée, the NFL never would have brought it out.
Oh, well, that's certainly true. And I quote in the book the fact that the incident occurred in February of, I'm going to press my fingers to my temples to remember which year, I think 13. The video didn't become public until September. But 2 days after the incident occurred, local newspapers reported that Ray Rice had knocked his fiancée unconscious. So everybody knew the basic fact. The fact that it was a violent event was well known. The NFL didn't do anything about it until there was a video that made it visceral in a way. But we're a visual society that reacts to images. Think about 50,000 civilians killed in Syria 2 and 3 years ago. Nobody reacted to that at all when there was that horrifying, visceral image of a man's head being cut off, then suddenly we cared about Syria. That's I think, again, this reflects the fact that as a society, we respond more to images than we do to words.
What about the effect of social media on the NFL? Has it increased the interest? Has it been a negative impact to the league? Some of the players really kind of make fools of themselves on social media, but so do other people.
I was going to say, what isn't that what social media is for? Some of them do look pretty silly. I think in general, we're treating social media as a lot more significant than it really is. But you could certainly say that the NFL unfolds that too.
We're speaking with Greg Easterbrook. Brooke about his book, The Game's Not Over, in defense of football. We'll take a short break. We'll come back and take your calls and continue our conversation. Stay with us.
Everybody psyched for football tonight.
Well, then I think the last line is the savior is Roger Goodell. That's a parody of the Sunday Night Football theme song, brutally honest NFL theme song. It's sung and co-written by Bonnie McKee. So we're back with Greg Easterbrook, author, contributing editor to The Atlantic and Washington Monthly. Writes the Tuesday morning quarterback column for The New York Times, former columnist for ESPN.com. And he's written The Game's Not Over in defense of football. Again, if you'd like to join in the conversation, our number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, email radio at WLRN.org.
Greg Easterbrook, let's touch a little bit on the NFL and the subsidies it gets from communities where there are teams. I'm thinking of St. Louis has now lost two teams. The Rams were immensely popular and profitable during the greatest show on turf years. The owner put in a crummy team the last 10 years, and now because they supposedly aren't getting enough support, they're moving to Los Angeles, and St. Louis, twice now, is left in the lurch. What are your feelings on that?
I certainly hope California taxpayers have their hands firmly on their wallets, because money is likely to be subtracted. The standard estimate is that the NFL gets roughly $1 billion a year in taxpayer subsidies to build and operate its stadia. And of course, the NFL is an immensely profitable enterprise. There's no reason it should get a single penny in subsidies. Many, not all of the stadiums also get gifts of land from the public. That's involved in the Englewood Stadium deal in California, and land near LA is very valuable. Various tax exemptions or tax abatements, free utilities, other things. There's no reason that there should be any public money at all flowing to the NFL. Now, these arrangements started a half a century ago or longer ago when there was far less money, even if you adjust the current dollars in professional sports, than there is today. And the idea that the public should subsidize stadia began at a time when NFL owners couldn't really have paid to build stadiums themselves, but now they all can. It's absurd that the public pays anything. And yet, where's the populist outrage, or where's the crusading politicians that are trying to end these abuses?
Well, it's also pretty amazing that you point out that with their gazillions of dollars, these owners, the taxpayers are playing for the stadiums. Most of the taxpayers can't afford a ticket to see the game because they're too expensive. And then on top of that, they usually keep a player for shy of 4 years so he can't get all the benefits of all the perks that come with 4 years in the NFL.
Yes, you will find, if you look at any NFL roster, though, you'll find that an awful lot of players are first, second, or third year. That's because in the fourth year, you vest for benefits and for a higher minimum salary. The players who have been playing for their teams for 5 or 6 years, and those are the ones whose names you're more likely to know, those guys have very high average incomes. They get lifetime health care. They get a very desirable league run 401k plan. Those guys are set for life as long as they're careful with their money. But most of the players are first, second, and third year players who are getting minimum salaries that are nice compared to you and me, but that they'll only earn for a couple of years after years of preparation, and they're waived the day before they would vest for health care and 401k protection. And that's one of the many, many sleazy things that the owners do to their players.
Getting back to Stadia, I haven't been to Dallas and seen that glitzy operation, but the best place to see a football game for my money and atmosphere was the old crummy Orange Bowl.
Well,
you were right on top of the action. You didn't have all the lights flashing. It was such a feeling that, and it was also, you know, Vox Populi there.
Well, if you think, one of the things I did for this book was, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and as a child I attended games in the old War Memorial Stadium, which no longer exists, a beautiful early 30s WPA project that was built mainly by stonemasons. And I looked up ticket costs and converted them into current dollars, and the ticket costs of that stadium in the 1960s when the Bills were champions of the old AFL was $6 to enter and sit in the bleachers, and $40 to sit in the best seats in the house. That's in today's dollars.
Oh.
Now, in any NFL stadia today, those numbers are going to be 10 times that, right?
Yeah.
Right. I want to, before we get there, move on to the subject of CTE, Greg, because a chronic traumatic encephalopathy, because in your book you write that CTE may be caused by head impacts, but I was under the impression that science has proven that the concussive hits and even the subconcussive hits, or maybe that second impact you're talking about, has definitely caused CTE.
Well, the answer to that is yes, definitely, probably, maybe. If you've seen the Will Smith movie Concussion or read the work of Bennett Amalo, the scientist who's a real, actual scientist that movie largely fictionalizes, Amalo's done great work in bringing CTE into the conversation. It was very slightly known even 10 years ago. It can only be diagnosed by autopsying the brain. Brain autopsies are very rare. There's been less than 1,000 of them done so far. And almost all the brains that have been autopsied are the brains of older former NFL players or soldiers who have died violent deaths in battle. So the autopsies have been done on the brains of people who have gone through extreme contact, head contact events. And yeah, they do show CTE, and CTE is really troubling. There have been 2 or 3 autopsies of young men in their 20s who have died young. Obviously, CTE can only be diagnosed in the deceased, who have died young and then been autopsied football players and shown CTE. So the big question is the CTE condition, is it exclusive to contact sports and to military service, in which case, as I say, and the game's not over, we're going to have a complete reassessment of the nature of contact sports and also of society's debt to military veterans? Or is it, this is equally possible, is it that CTE is a common condition, that it's the root cause of dementia, and if you autopsy anybody's brain after they die of dementia, you're going to find CTE?
Mm.
That is the big question mark unknown.
Really? I was unaware of that, that there was that kind of a question
that anybody
out there. Yeah.
I think talk to neurologists and you'll find that the neurology community can, the fact that CTE exists has been proven, and the fact that some deceased older football players have it, those two things have been proven. Everything else, I think, is an unknown. And one reason, you notice that the league signed a brain trauma settlement with its older players about 2 years ago. That settlement technically has not yet been approved by the federal judge who's controlling it. Everybody expects her to approve it. But the reason that they signed it when they did, and it's roughly $1 billion transferred from the owners to the former players, is they wanted that the ink dried on that agreement before such time as science may be able to establish that football causes CTE.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. If that's ever established, the legal picture of the sport will change very dramatically. And the legal picture of soccer and diving, the other concussion sports, will also change.
Let's take a telephone call or two. Our number, if you'd like to get in, 1-800-743-9576, or email, that's radio@wlrn.org. Next up, it's Linda. She's in Fort Lauderdale. Hi there.
Hi there. I made an anthropological observation a few years ago when I was on a dating website. Every week after the game of the week ended, I would get so many emails. So do you want to analyze that observation? I mean, my email incoming just lit up so. It was hysterical.
Okay.
Maybe the games had testosterone going.
Exactly. I went to Roger Goodell's high school. My brick is quite near his outside, Bronxville High School. He was class of 77. He now earns $44 million per year, and the owners all love him.
I bet I could do his job for $44 million.
Well, he doesn't really.
I'm sure Greg Easterbrook could too, right, Greg?
Well, the line I use about him in The Game's Not Over is that his most recent salary is a mere $35
million. 35.
Is that Roger Goodell is a water boy who earns $35 million a year because the owners hold the real power. Goodell is the public face who squirms in public, and we, as a society, we seem to like, he's the CEO-like figure. We seem to like it when CEOs squirm in public, but the real power is held by the owners.
Greg Easterbrook, he's written The Game's Not Over, In Defense of Football, our last break, and we will be right back.
Reminds me of Brent Musburger days.
I remember him.
Phyllis George.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, by the way, speaking of Brett Musburger and Phyllis George, wait a minute, Greg, you say how we should best watch football, and the first thing that everybody should do is turn off the sound. And, I mean, are all football announcers created equal? Not really.
No, some are better than others. In general, I think football announcers spend far too much time talking about the owners and the celebrities about who are at the game and not enough time actually watching the contest. So I often just simply turn off the sound, and I would encourage your listeners to give it a try. Now, maybe you like the announcer. If you like him, then that's fine. But try turning off the sound when you watch a game. It will immediately heighten your senses to what's actually happening on the field. And if you've got any kind of home entertainment or sound surround system, a lot of people do, there is actually a way to turn off the announcers and still hear the crowd noise, which makes it exactly like you were actually at the game. And if all you have to do is Google the phrase "turn off announcers 5.1," the number 5.1, and you'll find instructions on how to do that.
I'm always wondering about why the producers don't stop these announcers and the guys pregame and postgame from saying the word football a million zillion times. It's a great football coach. It was a great football game. He's a great good football line. He threw the football. He ran the football. As though we don't know what the ball is in the game or what game we're watching.
What kind of ball it is, right? Well, most of these guys don't have a rich vocabulary, let's put it that way.
Greg, I want to ask you predict that the abuse and overuse of prescription drugs in the NFL is going to be a next issue that's going to be tackled, so to speak. But I was thinking players come by their drug use to begin with, at least pretty honestly, right or wrong, to prevent feeling pain during a game, to deal with pain so that they can continue playing a game, or to manage the pain in the aftermath of a game.
Well, I do think it's the coming scandal. And let me quickly go back to something you said earlier, Bonnie. You pointed out that it's widely believed, although impossible to know, that most instances of domestic abuse are never reported to the police. So does that mean that there's a lot of domestic abuse by football players that's never reported to the police? I mean, it could be. It's just how do we know what's
right,
not being reported? But now let's think about prescription painkillers. That we're sure that they are very broadly used in NFL locker rooms. And I'm talking about not illegally obtained drugs, but drugs that are legally obtained, mainly narcotic painkillers, mm-hmm. things in the OxyContin and similar family. And also this nefarious stuff called Toradol, which most NFL, most is an exaggeration, which a large number of NFL players have injected into their bodies before games. I think most Americans don't even know that Toradol exists. And then they turn on the TV and they watch these really brave, fearless players throwing their bodies around as if they felt no pain. It's because they don't feel any pain. They're on painkillers. And I've been trying for years to get the NFL to release to me or to anybody the anonymized data about how much legally prescribed painkillers individual teams use. I'm not trying to get any individual patients, essentially their patients in this context, medical records. I just want to know the total amount of legally prescribed painkiller that the New York Giants or the Miami Dolphins uses.
But who should be monitoring that?
Well, right now nobody is. I think if we had that number, and I think if the public and Congress saw it, people would be shocked.
That would allow you to inflict injury much easier if you're not feeling any pain.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Sure, of course. And it sets an example, and again, you can go back to people say, and perhaps fairly, but these are grown men who assume risk in return for a lot of money. What's wrong with that? Well, probably there's nothing wrong with that. But they set an example for the 3 million youth and high school players who aren't on painkillers and who aren't going to make $5 million this year and who aren't going to get a recruiting boost to college. They throw their bodies around fearlessly and sustain injuries that complicate their lives in return for no benefit. I think that's why this kind of stuff has to be disclosed and regulated.
Greg Easterbrook, could you touch briefly on the NFL and this constant identification with the armed forces, that we're supposed to have sort of the same reverence for the NFL as we do for the actual armed forces, and that link with the NFL and the military? It's like they're a division of the Defense Department or something.
Well, it drives me crazy, and I'm certainly not the only one. And I point out many times in this book that the NFL likes to suggest that it has something or other to do with national security, which of course it doesn't. But that makes you sound important. It makes it sound like the public shouldn't be questioning the expenses to the NFL, not only just the flyovers before the Super Bowl. I'll be at the Super Bowl this coming Sunday night.
And the government pays for that, of course.
Yes, and you know, if it's the Air Force or the Navy flying its high-tech stuff over the stadium, maybe they can say, well, this is good for recruiting.
Yeah.
Maybe there's an argument there. But the NFL, with flag bearers marching on the field, and each year now for several years, the weekend of Veterans Day, the NFL's dressed up all of their coaches in this stuff that looks like military fatigues,
yeah.
as if vaguely to suggest somehow they're military officers, so don't question us. And when you see college football games, I love college football, it's good too, the winning coach always has state troopers surrounding him as if he was some vital national security figure. It's all a big fraud, and why people don't catch on to that, I'm not sure either.
We have an emailer, Greg. Sean writes, if kickoffs are relatively unsafe, but punt plays present an average risk of injury, why not replace kickoffs with punts from, say, the 50-yard line with a penalty if the punt goes out of bounds? Otherwise, would you just have the offense start with the ball on the 20-yard line as they do today in the event of a touchback?
Well, you're still running the opposite direction, though, if you punt instead of kick from the field.
For your emailer, I favor the latter. I favor just treating everything, after each field goal or touchdown, just treat it as a touchback. Give the opponent a starting position on its 20, and after a safety, give the opponent starting position on its 35, and just treat everything as a touchback.
Oh, here's another emailer. I can't, about women in the NFL. What are your thoughts on transgender women coming to the NFL, given the new normal on gender preference and gender equality, as well as men currently in the NFL having same-sex interests? The lines become blurred as it relates to NFL being male-dominated.
Well, NFL is male-dominated and always will be male-dominated. I assume that the percentage of men who are homosexual in the NFL is the same percentage of society as a whole. And because a gay man has the same chance of being muscular and big as any other kind of man does. So if you assume that NFL players are as likely to be gay as any other man is, then you got to figure there's probably around 50 gay players in the NFL. And I assume that NFL cheerleaders are as likely to be gay as any other women are. And so there's got to be 20 lesbian NFL cheerleaders. I don't see why the numbers wouldn't be same for people inside the NFL as out of it. Transgender, maybe. I mean, the key thing is to keep barrier that would face a woman trying out for the NFL. You're talking about a game where physical size and physical strength is not only at a great premium, but even really big, really strong men sometimes aren't big and strong enough. So for a woman or a transgendered individual to try out for the NFL, whatever their gender status was, they'd have to be incredibly big, incredibly strong, and athletically superior to all but the top 0.5% of the world's athletes, and the odds of that happening are just pretty low.
Well, one other little issue I had when in the book on the subject of Junior Seau, we had on Jim Trotter. Are you familiar with his book, Junior Seau, The Life and Death of a Football Icon?
I have not read it, but I do know of it, yes.
Well, you write that it's impossible to know whether football was a factor in his suicide, but if you read the book, you'll see Jim Trotter had a conversation with him 2 weeks before he committed suicide, and it looks like it's more than just the statistics of Pacific people,
Samoans
committing suicide, and that it looks like there was definitely a link between CTE and Junior Seau's suicide. And yes, I know he was just divorced and he was depressed, but that too is a symptom of the CTE, not the cause. You know what I mean?
I think at this point, Bonnie, all you can say is maybe. I can tell you that the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, has studied suicide and former football players, and the link to this, the data for the study is in my book, and found that former NFL players are significantly less likely to commit suicide than men of the same age.
So, well,
I mean, it could happen to an individual. Suicide, the true understanding of it usually dies with the person. So,
what do you see for the future? We just have about a minute left.
Well,
as we
discussed earlier, I want the NFL to continue to make changes in the way the game is played, to not make it risk-free, that will never happen, but to do everything possible to reduce neurological risk, and not just to protect NFL players, but to set a good example for college, high school, and youth leagues. Youth, in turn, I think youth football should not be played pads tackle football before middle school age, and if necessary, should be outlawed. All the pediatric research shows that the brain is much more vulnerable before the age 13 than it is afterward. And don't take my word for it. Take Archie Manning's, father of Peyton and Eli, would not allow them to put on a helmet until they were 13 because he knew the pediatric research.
But
those are big things coming.
I'm just thinking there are probably some stars in the NFL who did start before the age of 13, though. Peyton and Eli might not have, but some may have.
There are, but there are Pro Bowl players, Antonio Gates is one of them, who didn't even play football in high school. So you don't have to start young. And I can tell you that some of what's to me the most disturbing neurological and brain trauma research going on right now shows that the biggest dividing line about whether aging football players have chronic degenerative neurological conditions or not is whether they played tackle football before the age of 13.
Okay. Well, Greg Easterbrook, author, contributing editor to The Atlantic and Washington Monthly, has written The Game's Not Over, In Defense of Football. Have a good time at the Super Bowl, Greg, and thanks for joining
us. Thank you, Greg.
Okay, thank you guys for having me.
And thanks for tuning in. Apologies to callers we couldn't get to. Lead producer Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. Michael Stock helped us out as well today. And if you missed some of the program, we have free audio archives for download at our website. That's WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Bonnie and I return Thursday with a look at revitalization efforts in the Miami-Dade city of Opa-locka. The town with Moorish architecture is making surprising progress. Also, Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining is her annual, guess what, Super Bowl Party Bash program.
Again, we want to thank our guests and for supporting WLRN and for being with us today. We have another guest today It's take your
a very pretty one.
Daughter or son to school. To work. Work, right. What's your name?
Hi, I'm Scarlett Zappa.